Happy to have you aboard here for the Really Big Barbecue Show. Boing.
We cook because we have to, and we grill because we want to.
Hit me. Fine. How's it going?
You have a great show. I'm a big fan. Boing. So what seems to be the problem here? This man looks like he's dead, and he's in the crackle.
Charbono! It's all about the Charbono, dude!
Succulent fish! What?
He ate 54 wieners.
Oh, listen, Libertius, shut your face.
I'm shaking like a dog shit peach seeds.
We have top men working on it right now. Top men.
Hey, just like that, we're in the second hour, Barbecue Central Show. We are a little late, so this open will be, as we say, a bridge. The show happens every Tuesday from 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern. We do it live.
We'll do it live.
It's also being recorded, in case you miss it, on the live aspect. You can get it hour number one tomorrow, hour number two on Thursday. You can get a best moments of show on Friday. We'll talk about that here in a second. The show, of course, originating from
Palm City, USA. Cleveland.
Still to come on the show tonight, Barry Enderwick. In just a few short moments, Chris Young will close out the show. We say good evening to those of you watching tonight through one of our video streaming platforms. You can go to facebook.com/BBQCentralShow. You can go to twitter.com/BBQCentralShow. You can also watch on YouTube, which is youtube.com/@BBQCentralShow, where we have a YouTube poll question of the week, and we're asking everybody this. Lamb is the most underrated protein to go on the grill, yes or no? And currently 67% of you are saying yes, it is the most underrated protein to go on the grill, and 33% of you are saying no, it is not. Are some people seeing that? I forgot I had that on my head. I was going to take that off, and then I got busy doing nonsense and missed it. The hearing button on my head. So I don't know how many people... You recall that over... Like a month ago, whatever it was, I had the hearing bone implant. Remember, I did the show when somebody backed out or didn't show up or whatever happened. Well, last Wednesday, I had the actual hearing speech processor put on that thing. And here's what it looks like. Ready? Can you see that? What do you mean, can you see that? Of course you can see it. It looks like a slug. Sucking my brain. The good news is this. Aside from the potentially off-putting aesthetic, an immediate benefit. I could hear just like that. Now, how would I describe it? Is it robust? Is it deep and rich basses and mid-ranges and high levels? Do I have tweeters and subs in this thing like I do in my in-ear monitors? No. But sacrificing the fidelity in the ear, but just getting hearing, it was a win. As soon as it snapped on, I could hear way better than I could before. And then really what shined, so outside of that, we had the peripheral items that came along with it. There was a little microphone thing that clips to you. Now, that also doubles as like a Bluetooth bridge, so I can technically take phone calls where the sound goes from the microphone bridge and it goes to right to here. And then I can hear you through the metal titanium hearing bone implant. But the best piece that has come along with this peripherally is the TV streamer. So this thing hooks up through the optical audio in the back of the streaming box or the back of the television. It's all running through an app on the phone. I pick TV streamer, and now the TV audio is coming right to this thing that's implanted in my head. And it comes in at a high rate. So I only have to have it up like volume one because I'm trying to match it to the ear that works, to the ear that doesn't. And I don't have to have it jacked all the way up or anything like that at all. That is remarkable. And I can leave the room. So before, like we're watching the Cavs game, for instance, I leave the room. I got to take a phone call. Got to go take a leak, what have you. Becky pauses the game. Guess what? Now you don't have to pause. Keep running because the audio continues to spit to this thing in my head. It's like I'm watching television and now I'm listening to the radio call. So there's no need for me to have to pause anything anymore because I can hear everything happening as it's happening live. I just can't see it, but I can still hear it good enough, especially the way the Cavs have been playing the last few games. So that's the update. Episode 332 this coming Friday, Best Moments Show, featuring first ever studio guest in the show, my dad, the air boss, Bill Rempe. So stay tuned for that. And I had a whole big write-up there, but I got sidetracked with the thing that's in my ear. And then, of course, don't forget that the new season of the Famous Dave's All-Star Barbecue Challenge Series starts in 19 days. As I mentioned with Mike McLeod last segment, two events that kick off the opening weekend of May 18th. Fresno, California, and there were spots open, as I checked earlier today, but Union Gap, Washington is currently full, so you can't get in there. And remember, not only teams have the opportunity to win cash prizes, the GC and RGC win bids to the barbecue portion of the 2024 World Food Championships in Indianapolis, Indiana. WorldFoodChampionships.com/allstars is the place that you want to go to get all your World Food Championship Famous Dave info. The sandwich man, Barry Enderwick, is ready to go. We will get to him here in 1 second. Before we do that, I'm talking to you about our pal Aaron Franklin and his brand of barbecue pits. These are the backyard versions of the famed pits built by Aaron Franklin for his renowned barbecue restaurant in Austin, Texas, Franklin Barbecue. Built for those purists who want to take their craft to the next level. And what you have with the Franklin pit is a deeply thought out and refined version of the old propane style cooker that he uses at his restaurant. Stylistically, it reflects the kind of bare bones industrial handmade aesthetic that he loves, like the patina and the way the build allows you to see the welds and craftsmanship. Now, the schematics of a Texas off-style pit are relatively simple, even if the things that happened inside reflect complicated dynamics of physics and chemistry. There's very few moving parts. Numerous and massive differences divide the Franklin barbecue pit and the average barbecue smoker sold at the barbecue store. For one, much of the challenge of building and shipping these pits come from the thickness and the weight, but also much of the value. Cheap smokers are made from thin metal. Not only does cheap metal tend to warp and crack when sustaining the kind of high heat you need to make great briskets, but especially on cold days like we've had here in Cleveland for the last 6 months, the thinness of the metal just sheds the heat, struggles to maintain consistent temperature. That's nonsense. The Franklin pit, primarily made with quarter-inch thick American-made steel, that's strong. Anything that sees heat, engineered to be incredibly solid, should hold heat and last for more than a century if cared for properly. You can find them at specialty retailers nationwide, a growing dealer, of course. If you, the listener of the show, own a store and you wish to become a Franklin Barbecue Pit dealer, you can visit the website franklinbbqpits.com and fill out the dealer form. If you're a listener that wants one but you don't have a dealer near you, you can buy one on that website, franklinbbq.com. Purchase Franklin Barbecue Pit, and it ships right to the bottom of your driveway. Accessories, too, if you want them. Rubs, books, such. But it's either way. You either want to become a dealer or you want to become a customer, and you go to the same website, franklinbbqpits.com. That's franklinbbqpits.com. And we are back with our pal Barry Enderwick right here. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Barbecue Central Show. Howard Stern, Jim Rome, Dan Patrick, and Greg Rempe. The Mountain Rushmore of talk show entertainment. Now, let's get back to the Barbecue Central Show.
Welcome back. This portion of the show being brought to you by Pit Barrel Cooker, the most unbelievable outdoor cooking device on the planet. Currently available in 3 sizes, a host of accessories. Doesn't matter if you're a beginner or a professional, it's a cooker you want to add to the arsenal. pitbarrelcooker.com is the website to go to. I had an extensive conversation with co-owner Noah Glanville, and he's working on something. Whereas Chris Young has shook the very foundations of Live Fire, Noah Glanville might be doing something that could shake the very foundation of cookers as we know them. So stay tuned for that as things start to leak out from there. Leading off the second hour, a man who is an expert in sandwiches, all types, all sizes. He's making them, eating them, plussing some of them up, and rating them. You can follow along on his Instagram account, or you can go to his website. We welcome back our pal and creator of Sandwiches of History, Barry Enderwick. Barry, we have a YouTube poll question of the week that we're asking everybody, including all guests, which is you. Lamb is the most underrated protein on the grill, yes or no?
I mean, lamb is fantastic on the grill. I don't know if it's underrated. I mean, let's put it this way. If you've not had grilled lamb, then yes, it's underrated. But if you've had it, there's no way it's underrated.
So we're going with yes or no.
Oh, come on now. I'm going to say no. It's not underrated.
Of course, 36% of the voting public agree with you, Barry, that it is not underrated. And 64% of us are saying, yes, it is underrated. Even if you've had it and you had it again, you're like, wow, it's still that great. It's underrated. Where I feel like a great steak, I'm like, yeah, it's a great steak. But every time I have lamb, I'm like, oh my God, it's just as good. It's like the first time all over again. So underrated in that. That's the way I'm inferring my question that I wrote for everybody else to then infer on their own. Look, before we get into sandwiches that you've recently attempted, where does the catchphrase "ago" come from?
Deep in the recesses of my mind. That's not something that I planned. I just sort of it came out and I said it a couple times and then I kept saying it. And that's pretty much the whole thing on Sandwiches of History. Like the whole idea of plussing something up. I know I didn't, there's no way I came up with the idea of plussing something up, but that's just something I said and I said it again. And now I say it. It's like, I don't know.
Have you, just me. Did you hear the term plus up or I'm plussing up? Until you said it, I'd never heard that before in my life. And I like to think I'm kind of a wordsmith in a professional order. And never have I heard it.
Well, I can honestly say that I don't recall having heard it, but I can also admit that my publisher happened to watch a low budget, terrible documentary on Walt Disney. And apparently he used to ask his Imagineers to plus ideas up. Now, I had never heard it, but again, this isn't something, there's no way I came up with that. There's just no way. So, maybe I did hear it. Maybe I didn't. I don't know. I don't think so, but I'm definitely not the one who, I'm not the first person to ever say plus it up.
Barry, you strike me.
It's part of the reason why Disney Plus is Disney Plus, by the way.
Interesting. Well, yeah, but it would be Disney Plus up, not just Disney Plus. Like Disney Plus is in addition, plus up is a whole different thing, I think.
I think it's a conceptual thing. That's all.
I think you're an honest enough guy where if you knew you heard it somewhere, you'd be like, Tony Ricky Bobby's the guy that used to say it. I liked it. I started.
Absolutely.
So we're going with the fact that Barry Enderwick created. You've coined the phrase plus up. And we're announcing it here officially on the Barbecue Central Show. Right. One of the sandwiches that you've done within the last 2 weeks or so is a name hopefully we've all heard. Not only is he a great chef, cook, but a great humanitarian with his nonprofit cause, Jose Andrus's omelet sandwich. So what can you give us from a history standpoint and then give us the Barry review?
You know, I don't know much on the history of it because he's just a madman in the kitchen. But that sandwich was pretty much an umami bomb, right? We've got Kewpie mayonnaise, which is made with egg yolks and MSG, already umami rich. And then you've got an egg omelet that's just basically egg. Then you smear on top of that this tomato frito that's kind of like a sauce that cooks down for an hour and a half. Then you put on top of that tuna belly in oil. And then you top it with furikake seasoning from Japan. It was ridiculous and delicious all at the same time. And it was. It was just a ton of savoriness. I would eat that again in a hot minute any day.
Is it a arduous process of preparation? And also, to follow up on that, where does one source tuna belly?
Well, tuna belly is pretty widely available. Actually, you could just get and if you couldn't get tuna belly, you can get tuna fillets that are in the jar that are in oil that they have at the grocery store. That would work fine as well. The only part of that sandwich that was kind of onerous was making the tomato sauce frito. But the only reason I did that is because I went to buy his sauce and it was like $13 a jar. Okay, it's a little expensive, but that's fine. Every once in a while, I'll splurge. But then the shipping was like 2 to 3 times as much as the jar. Yeah. I'm like, screw that. I am making it myself.
Yeah.
So that's the only part that was a little bit arduous. Everything else is quite easy, and you can just throw it together quickly if you already had the tomato sauce.
Not to belabor a subject called mayonnaise, but you appear to be trying a lot of different white toppings of all sorts and fashions there. We'll talk about one here in a second. Mayonnaise. It looked terrible. Specific to Kewpie, where do you fall out on the Kewpie love-hate?
I love it. Yeah. I absolutely love it. But here's the thing. I get a lot of comments where folks are like, this is the best mayonnaise, bar none. And it's like, not every mayonnaise is right for every application. You know, Kewpie's got a lot of umami. It's pretty rich. Duke's is fantastic. It's made with egg yolks, but it's also made with apple cider vinegar. So it's got a tang to it. And so for me, it's not just there's one mayonnaise to rule them all. It's what is the right mayonnaise for the application. So I dig mayonnaise. I just all kinds of mayonnaise. I probably have 2 or 3 on hand at any given time.
When you're looking at a sandwich recipe and it's calling for mayo, are you now, because of what you just explained to us, are you looking at the individual ingredients and saying, I'm going to reach for a Hellman's, or I'm going to reach for a Duke's or a Kewpie, and that's what I'm using because these ingredients are telling me to use this?
So if I'm doing a recipe from a recipe book, and let's say it's 1920 something, and it's calling for a mayonnaise, I'm just using a regular straight up mayonnaise. I'm not going to use Kewpie. I'm not going to use Duke's. I'm not going to use anything that has any particular characteristics that make it outside the norm of a regular mayonnaise, because that's probably close to what would have been used back then. But if I'm making for International Sandwich Sunday, for example, if I'm making a sandwich that's from Japan, I'm busting out the Kewpie mayonnaise.
Yeah. One of the other sandwiches that you made that I found to be, you read the name and you're like, I mean, what else could be in it? But there was other stuff in it. The lettuce sandwich, circa everybody's birth year 1900. What did you like or not like about the sandwich?
What did I like about the sandwich? I like the name. It's very straightforward. It's very simple. It's also a lie, which I don't like, because the main ingredient was not lettuce. It was peanut butter and this just terrible mayonnaise-like dressing that they had you make. And on Sandwiches of History, I follow the recipe as written. And so I get lots of people like, you should have done this. You should have done this. It's like, I know that. I'm following the recipe as they wrote it.
Right. That's the deal.
And it was disgusting. The peanut butter. Why was peanut butter in a lettuce sandwich? Why was the mayonnaise dressing and peanut butter in a lettuce sandwich? Lettuce was the least pronounced thing about it, and yet it was called a lettuce sandwich. 1900.
Bad year for sandwiches. I'm looking at you making this step by step, and as you lay the bread out and then the peanut butter goes on, immediately my head's like, wow, like where could we possibly go from here? I thought I was going to see lettuce and then the top go on it. And you're like, oh, it's a lettuce sandwich. So peanut butter and a light dusting, or as you said, a whisper of peanut butter. And then whatever the hell that homemade mayo sauce was, I saw that and I looked at it and I said, well, this is where it goes extremely bad. But geez.
Oh, yeah.
That was
went into the ditch there.
You will just pound right through it. You looked completely not unnerved. You looked confident and you stood right there and you put it in. You're like, wow, this sucks. And I was like, well, what? I would have been way more trepidatious just because of what was there on the mayonnaise side of it. But you just soldier right through.
I tend to embrace the concept that comedians use of commit to the bit, commit to the bite. And so it's just you know, you got to try it. You made it, try it. And sometimes I've been surprised where I thought something was going to be not great and it turned out to be pretty good. Mm. So
let's talk about, had mentioned, the term that you coined that we've officially announced tonight, the plus up process. So regardless of the sandwich you're eating, are you immediately thinking about how to make it better or potentially better? Or are those first few bites one of those things where you're like, this is good on its own? Or is there a more deliberate process to figure out what ingredients might enhance the overall Sando experience?
Yeah. So the origins of plussing it up, when I first started Sandwiches of History, I wasn't doing that. But I found that there were several sandwiches that I was tasting. And it's like, you know what? With just like an ingredient or two, this could actually be something I'd want to eat again. So the concept is make sandwiches as written and plus them up for the modern palate. But usually, probably about 99% of the time, I think about plus ups when I read the recipe itself. I'm like, oh, you know, it'd be interesting to try here is this. And I'll write it down. And that might change between the time I plan the recipe and actually shoot it. Often not. But there are times when I have to actually taste the sandwich before I can even think about what might be possible. So it's a little combination, but mostly it's, I read the recipe. I'm like, ooh, I think I know what would work here.
What's your, like, rate yourself as a foodie?
What's that?
Rate yourself as a foodie. Where do you
rate myself?
Yeah. Where do you think you are?
What's my scale?
Like, are you, do you fancy yourself a foodie? Do you think you're really good at cooking? Do you go to restaurants and like nitpick like a shithead, or like what's your level of foodieism? I was going to use a completely different word.
I totally do. Yeah.
Right.
No, I mean, yes and no. Like, I'll go to a Michelin star restaurant and if it's fantastic, I will enjoy the hell out of it. I love cooking. Do I think I'm great at cooking? I don't know. Sometimes I suck. I am definitely curious. I want to try stuff, whether that's flavors, textures, cuisines, you know, cooking techniques. So, you know, foodie feels like if you call yourself a foodie, it almost feels like you're a dilettante. Like you're like, oh, I'm up here and those people are down there. And I like great food. I like great wine. I like great beer. I like great, you know, craft cocktails and things like that. But I also like, you know, peanut butter and dill pickle sandwiches. Like, I like a good hot dog. So I'm not precious about food, but I am very curious about food.
If you look back over the history of sandwiches that you have plussed up, are there two or three ingredients that you found that you reach for the most in a consistent basis, or is it all over the board?
I can tell you right now that most sandwiches could be plussed up with bacon, which is why I have to kind of be judicious about using that as a plus up, because then it'd be just Sandwiches of History plus bacon. But I tend to gravitate towards a little bit of heat. And I also tend to gravitate towards texture. So if I can add a little crunch to something that needs crunch, or if I can add a little heat to something that I think needs heat, those are the things I'll do. Spice blends are also a go-to, like a five spice or Chinese five spice or Old Bay or J.O. spice, or like Ras Al Hanout. Like all these different warm spice blends work well with different sandwiches. So I tend to kind of lean that way. But every once in a while, you know, you got to plus it up with like lettuce and the seasoned tomato.
Do you have local restaurants, eateries reach out to you and say, hey, Barry, we love what you're doing on Sandwiches of History. Come to our place and do some kind of a sandwich review, or let's put a sandwich together?
I've had, one or two reach out and say, hey, you should come by. But, you know, one's an hour away and the other I'm not really interested in. So I just sort of, no, not really.
I asked you about the possibility of Sandwiches of History becoming a TV show last time. What about Sandwiches of History, a book? Is that a better possibility or no?
That's not just a possibility, my friend. That's actually going to happen this fall.
Really?
Slated to come out on, Sandwiches of History, the cookbook, will be out either the first week in November or in October. And I'm actually working on trying to put together potentially a event tour in support of it. Right now, slated specifically for New York, Chicago, and one other city, but I'm not 100% sure yet. And we'll see. I've got a lot of work to do to see if that can even happen. But yeah, the cookbook is coming out this fall.
Not to ask the stupid question here, but are the recipes in this cookbook your favorite recipe or sandwiches of history that you've done, or what's the construct here?
Yeah, so they're not all 10s, because there aren't that many 10s from the old cookbooks, but they're a good representational sample of interesting sandwiches across different categories. Like they're broken into like tea, snack sandwiches, sweet sandwiches, savory sandwiches, international sandwiches. And I've gone through and made them so that you can make a sandwich, because most of these old recipes are like makes 12 sandwiches. And it's like, well, that's not very helpful for your average person. So let's get it down to one. And then other things like, you know, including measurements, like how much cayenne pepper do you put in, and that sort of thing. So just going through kind of updating the recipes, modernizing them, including plus up ideas. There's a couple of, a few deep dives on condiments like ketchup, mustard, mayonnaise in the book. And there is one Sandwiches of History original sandwich in the book. Oh, and a few recipe remixes as well.
Do you have to like go back and ask for rights or anything, or are recipes pretty much precluded from any of that nonsense?
Recipes are not copyright protected. So someone could copy a recipe that I have in my book, and that's fine. The idea wasn't so much to just take them straight out of the books, because they're really not that usable straight out of the old books. So it was my attempt to go in, clean them up, add things that help, and make it into something that you could just follow, make, eat, as opposed to try to figure out what's going on, what were they thinking, which is most of these old recipes.
And that's coming out in the fall?
Yep.
All right. So we're going to look for that, and maybe next time on, we'll do a little hype segment for that, and we'll talk about some other things as well. We're talking with Barry Enderwick. Sandwiches of History on social, the website sandwichesofhistory.com. Barry, always appreciate the conversation, and continued success.
Thank you, Greg.
You got it. Barry Enderwick, right there. Eating sandwiches that both look delicious sometimes, and other times, what do they think? The lettuce sandwich with ingredients of lettuce and peanut butter and some homemade attempt at mayo that was loose and watery, which is not mayo. Somebody looking to take down the very foundations of if you should rest a steak or not is ready to join. Before we get to him, I'll talk to you about Big Papa Smokers. Listen up, gang. Our friends over at Big Papa's have something special for you, the listeners of the show. Whether you're a seasoned pitmaster or a grilling newbie, Big Papa Smokers, your one-stop shop for all things barbecue. Championship rubs, mouth-watering sauces, essential accessories. They've got what you need to take your food to the next level. Whether you're on the competition circuit or in the backyard, just like me, here's the cherry on top. Big Papa Smokers offering the listeners of the Barbecue Central show an exclusive deal. Use promo code REMPE at checkout, R-E-M-P-E. Get $10 off your next $50 purchase of rubs, sauces, and accessories. If you could imagine the possibility, that means taking Big Papa's sweet money and putting it on your ribs, or Big Papa's desert gold and putting it on your chicken, or better yet, pick up Double Secret and put it on your steak. Head on over to BigPapaSmokers.com and start shopping today. And don't forget to use the code REMPE at checkout, R-E-M-P-E, and claim your $10 off your next order of $50 or more. Big Papa's got a full line of recipes at CookingWithBigPapa.com. So if you're looking for ideas, go there. Follow him on social as well. Chris Young joins us next. Stick around.
You're listening to the Barbecue Central Show. whole packers, full racks, legs and thighs, injecting butts. If you've never heard this before, you might think you found the best Triple X show ever. Let's get back to the most homoerotic host out there today, Craig Rempe.
And we thank Barry Enderwick for joining us last segment. This portion of the show being brought to you by JRE Tobacco, makers of Aladino cigars and other fine brands like Sumatra, the Classic, the Corojo Reserva, the Habano, the Cameroon. Visit JRETobacco.com to find a retailer near you. And if you are a partaker in premium hand-rolled cigars and your place doesn't carry them, tell them to get on the ball. JRE Tobacco. Great cigars. Helping me close to the show tonight, founder of the predictive thermometer system called Combustion Inc. Aside from his disrupting of the wireless thermometer industry, he continues to turn out some seriously great content over at YouTube. At Chris Young Cooks is the handle over there, which currently has 162,000 subscribers. So if you aren't subscribed to it, head on over and sub up so you don't miss anything new. And tonight we're talking about something that may or may not help you cook a better steak, or may not be a huge waste of time. Specifically, happy to welcome back our pal Chris Young. Chris, appreciate you joining me here this evening. Before we talk about how you are shaking the very foundations of live fire, we have a YouTube poll question of the week that we're asking everybody and all guests. Lamb is the most underrated protein to go on the grill, yes or no?
Yeah, I think I could get on board with that, having lived and cooked in England, where lamb is a little more popular and grilled lamb is delicious. So yeah, I go with that.
Clawing back, it was in a distant lead of yeses, and now we're at 59% yes and 41% no, but I think we'll get there by the time the show ends here. So any updates to pass along as it relates to Combustion Inc., the business, before we talk about resting steak?
Yes, we have, of course, a Mother's Day sale going on right now through the 6th of May, where it's 20% off on all our bundles site-wide. So if you've been thinking about it and have felt that it's a little bit spendy, now is about the best deal we do all year. So it's a good time to get it. We are back in stock. And then the other news is one of the most requested features by our customers is I have been beta testing it all week, so it should ship next week, which is a cloud syncing capability. So if you have at least two mobile devices, if you have a tablet or a partner has an Android phone or an Apple phone, the app will be able to sync with the combustion thermometer, upload that to the cloud. And if you have another phone with you anywhere in the world with an internet connection, you will be able to keep an eye on your barbecue no matter what you're doing. And this has been wonderfully useful to me because I have been doing a lot of smoking lately in different smokers for some upcoming YouTube content. So being able to keep an eye on my predictive thermometer while I'm running to the store or coffee shops is useful.
So talking about YouTube for a second, I wanted to ask you about this item. Last time you were on the show, October, November, towards the end of last year, you had 93,000 subscribers. As I just mentioned in the open, you're cresting towards 165,000 subs at this point. YouTube, perhaps more than any other video platform, has become increasingly difficult to find the right wave to ride to ultimate YouTube success. What are the top two things do you think that have contributed to your growth over the last handful of months?
I do spend a lot of time thinking about what's going to make a successful video. There's a laundry list of things that I'm interested in, but don't necessarily, you know, pass the hurdle for it's worth making a video. The two things that I think have made my videos stand out is I try to choose topics that I think can be popular, but that haven't really been tackled from maybe my point of view of like, hey, let's look at the science. Let's try to do this empirically. I have a long track record of doing that with modernist cuisine, with going back to my time at the Fat Duck. I am a trained scientist before I was a chef. And so I think the style of videos that have done well for me and have allowed me to find an audience on YouTube is having these videos that really go into the hows and whys of cooking and say, hey, let's challenge some of these beliefs. Let's put them to the test and see what matters. the other side of it is there's plenty of people that will get on YouTube and try to talk about science, but I try to do it in a really visually compelling way. I try to show you the cooking process in a way you haven't seen before. We were very well known in modernist cuisine for cutting cookware in half and taking you inside the cooking process, but it was a book. You could only do certain things in pictures. And what's exciting about YouTube is, you know, we've cut a lot of cookware in half. We are cutting barbecue smokers in half. And I have some fantastic photographers that I work with and some great motion graphics artists who work with me to try to get the science right and in this really visually compelling way. So ultimately, it comes down to trying to tell a really good story that hopefully is relevant, hopefully is going to help you be more creative or be more confident when you choose to go out and you know, cook for the weekend, because that's a big ask already. It's so easy to push a button on your app and have food show up that asking somebody to take the time and cook a meal or go buy a $100 steak at Costco, like, you don't want to screw that up. So if I can help you have a better intuition for what matters and what doesn't matter so you feel more confident cooking, then I've done my job, and that seems to be finding an audience. And so that's also nice to see.
Last time you were on, we deconstructed butter basting steaks as they were cooking. If I remember, aside from feeling good while you were doing it, there wasn't a huge overall benefit to butter basting. This time around, we're talking the long debated let it rest rule that you hear from YouTube hacks all the way up to the biggest celebrity chefs on TV. Always preaching, let it rest, part of the cook, before we get into the findings. What's the setup for you to measure your findings? What's your process?
Yeah, so, you know, I think with resting, I had to divide it into two parts. One that, like, I'm not going to argue, it happens. Carryover cooking. You pull a steak off a grill. You pull it out of a hot pan. You let it sit on the cutting board, and its temperature will increase. And chefs, having been one, will tend to say, oh, it'll be 10 degrees, or maybe it's 15, or maybe it's 5. You ask different chefs, you're going to get very different answers. You know, I've spent the last 3 years as a trained mathematician with a big math team trying to be able to predict the carryover cooking. And it's like super hard. And I have a thermometer with 8 sensors that can measure everything going on. And we're doing hardcore physics simulations on the thermometer. And we can predict to within a couple of degrees most of the time. But it's not quite good enough for predicting or for releasing to the public. So with that in mind, you know, having pounded my head against this problem for years, I started to really question of, like, does it matter? And the, you know, the question you sort of always forget to ask is, like, does resting actually matter? Because the carryover cooking is a problem. If you leave it on the cutting board and you don't pay attention for a few minutes, you might have pulled that steak off at 120 degrees Fahrenheit. You want it to coast to 130 degrees. And by the time you get back to slicing on the cutting board because, you know, you were finishing the sauce or you're getting the potatoes done or whatever, all of a sudden now it's 136, 140. That's the difference between medium rare and medium. And it can even be worse than that. I've got examples of 30 or 40 degrees of carryover overshoot. So, you know, with that in mind, I basically wanted to say, well, the only reason that you can really say you shouldn't just start slicing into it as soon as it hits the doneness you want to stop the carryover in its tracks. Like, when you do that, when you slice it, the evaporative cooling, the steam leaving, just a couple grams of steam leaving is going to drop the temperature and stop any more carryover rise. So why not just slice it when it hits the doneness you want? I mean, it's pretty easy with the thermometer to keep an eye on the temperature. And, oh, it's 130 now. I better start slicing it on the cutting board. Well, the theory that many people share is, well, you're going to lose all the juices.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can make the argument of, well, is it better to let it cook from medium rare to medium? Like, is that a better trade-off? Personally, I don't think so. At least not for certain cuts of steak. But then it was actually Meathead, who's a friend of mine. And he said, you know, I don't think, you know, we've done testing and Greg Blonder's done testing and we think it doesn't really make much of a difference. And in modernist cuisine, you know, Nathan and I had done some experiments and we wrote about it and we had a hypothesis of why it might make some kind of difference. But Meathead basically challenged me to go test it again. So my setup was like, okay, I have a Breville temperature controlled induction burner. I can hold my cast iron pan at exactly the temperature I want to for the whole test. Something that I haven't seen anybody else do in their tests. I mean, I'm friends with Kenji. his temperature during his tests were not that controlled. Even Greg Blonder's temperatures were not that controlled. He was doing it on a standard burner. So I had a temperature controlled burner. I have a thermometer that lets me carefully measure the temperature as it cooks. And I basically, weighed the steak before cooking. I cooked the steak, and for one of them, I immediately weighed it after cooking. I let it weigh on the scale, and you could actually see as it rested, the weight dropped a little bit, about 1.5 grams, if I remember correctly, from evaporating steam. Because there is steam leaving, the crust didn't seal it in, and so it's losing a gram and a half. That's 8 droplets of water. But then, I sliced into it and I used a paper towel to absorb all the juices, and I had weighed the paper towel before and then I weighed it after. And, what you basically found is you lose about, I'm going from memory here, you lose about 12% of the weight of the meat just during the cooking process. That's the sizzle in the pan. That's juices that end up the pan. You can't do anything about that if you want to cook the steak. You're going to lose some juice just by cooking. Then, I did the resting where I took it off, I rested it, and I had worked it out so that it would rest to exactly 130 degrees. And then I sliced it, and I weighed how much juice I lost. I did another one where I cooked it right up to 130 degrees in the pan, pulled it out, weighed it, and immediately sliced into it to stop the cooking, mopped up all the juices and the paper towel, and weighed it again. The amount of juices lost were exactly the same. You lose around 6% of the weight once you slice it. And the physics actually turns out to be pretty interesting. The reason you lose juices is that if you heat water up, water has vapor pressure from steam. There's always some water evaporating, and that creates pressure. And when you cut the slice open, some of that steam pressure from the hot juices is able to push the juices that are nearest to the cut surface out. So when you slice a steak, you create a bunch of new surface area for juices to escape. Right. And if the steak is hot, above about 130 degrees, there's more than enough pressure to push juices near the surface out, which is why resting and not resting doesn't make any difference. You had the same amount of surface area. I sliced them the same way. The steaks were both about 130 degrees, or actually very close to 130 degrees in the surface, or in the center when I sliced them. You lose the same amount of juice. And to me, what that really says is it's not that you should never rest. Certainly people have interpreted this, if I'm insane, I'd never rest. Like, no, what I'm really saying is pull the steak off, don't stress yourself out that much. Pull the steak off a little bit early, knowing it's going to carry over. But keep an eye on the temperature. And as soon as it hits the doneness you want, just slice into it. You're not going to lose any more juice than if you slice into it after it's rested, but you don't have to let the steak overshoot, because an overcooked steak is really disappointing. So, people are obviously incredibly upset about this. About half the internet agrees, and the other half of the internet is coming up with increasingly implausible explanations of why I'm wrong, no matter, the fact that I did it 6 times, that I showed all my data on the screen. You have people saying, well, Kenji said, and it's like, well, Kenji's retesting it. I know him. He's actually seen my data. But you have people who just don't want to believe or change their belief in how you should cook a steak. And I'm coming along saying, you don't have to stress about it. Just don't let it overcook and slice into it when it's done.
So is the bigger issue here, or the biggest mistake here, people don't realize how much carryover is taking place. So if they're pulling at 125, they really
think... You're going to be disappointed.
Yeah, but they think, 130, maybe... Because maybe that's what they've been told all their life, and they don't realize it could go 15 to 25 degrees.
They actually sliced into it and started eating it before it went. Like, one of the things that's surprising to people is, yes, it typically in a pan roasted or a grilled steak, 1 inch thick, 1 3/4 inch thick, like a standard Costco steak, the carryover can be anywhere between about 20 Fahrenheit and 40 Fahrenheit. And it depends on the cooking temperature. And it depends a lot on how frequently you flip it. Mm. But here's the surprising thing. And I'll cherry pick a typical Costco steak. Costco cuts their steaks 1 3/4 inch thick. So I go through a lot of meat. Costco's a pretty good value for as much meat as I have to cook on camera. And when I do a 1 3/4 inch steak, depending, if I flip it frequently, it's going to be more carryover, surprisingly, than if I flip it less frequently, and get into why that is later. I've got a whole nother video about that. But what really surprises people is that steak will take about 12 minutes to reach the, you know, to reach the point where you should pull it out of the pan. Mm. And then you say, well, how long will it take for that carryover rise to reach all the way to its peak and then start going back down in the center? And it turns out it's about another 12 to 14 minutes. It takes as long to fully rest as it did to cook in the first place. Huh. So most people have never rested a steak all the way to the very end. Most people rest it 5 minutes or so and cut into it. And so they don't realize how big of a problem the carryover can be. And that's kind of the point. Just start slicing it when it's done you want. You were kind of doing that anyway. And you were losing juices no matter what. So, you know, I think it's a myth worth, it was a myth worth busting because it surprised me. I admitted I was wrong, and I've been a chef and have looked at this before, and I was like, well, my data says I was wrong. It doesn't matter what I believe before. And what it's meant is I've changed how I cook this summer. When I'm cooking steaks on the grill or chicken breasts, I'm going to cook it up to within 5 or 10 degrees of done with a thermometer. I'm going to pull it out, and then I'm going to give myself about 2 minutes, so 5, 10 degrees of carryover, and I'll keep an eye on it. And when it reaches the doneness I want to serve it to people at, I just start slicing, and I don't worry about the juices. You're going to lose them no matter what.
The other thing that's associated with resting is letting the meat relax. Do you find that there's a tenderness difference in a non-rested piece?
So this is almost worthy of another video. People have asked in the comments, no, I have not done a carefully controlled sensory test that's double blind and all of that, although it might be worth doing. I did eat a lot of these steaks, and you know, it wasn't, and I have trained palate, having been a three Michelin starred chef for 6 years. Like I've eaten a lot of steak, I've tasted a lot of meat. And here's what's surprising. The longer you rest the meat, actually, I find, and this does not apply to barbecue, I'm going to say that right now. Everybody who comes at me with, but briskets, yeah, briskets are different. Yeah. And you're cooking to much higher temperatures, and there's a lot more collagen. Like we're talking steaks, tender steaks. When the steak first comes off the grill and when it's at its hottest, that vapor pressure from the steam in the water actually causes the steak to swell a bit. And as it cools, that steam condenses and the water shrinks. When you shrink the steak, it gets more dense. More dense is tougher. So the steak is actually at its maximum tenderness when it's at peak temperature in terms of like how much bite force it takes. I don't think that's when it eats best, but no, I don't think resting magically relaxes the proteins. In a former life, I was a protein chemist. And when people say, oh, it's got to let the proteins relax, or the proteins have to relax and reabsorb the moisture. As a protein chemist, I don't know what the hell you're talking about because it's nonsense.
If you used a different cut of steak, would it yield the same results? Doesn't matter.
So you would get slight differences in the weight based on the marbling. Dry aged meat is going to lose less moisture during cooking, even though it started with lower moisture. The moisture that's left in a dry aged steak is more tightly bound to the proteins. The electrical chemical bonds are stronger. So you won't lose as much during the cooking, and you will probably lose less juice during the resting. So counterintuitively, if you have a dry aged steak, it starts out with lower moisture, but the end result actually can have higher moisture. A steak that's your typical 2 weeks to 21 days in a cryovac bag, it's going to be wetter. You're going to lose a lot more juices. So the absolute numbers that I show in my video, which were from a filet mignon, the center cut where I could keep everything very consistent from steak to steak to steak, you will probably get slightly different numbers with a different cut of meat. And if you use two steaks that are from different animals, or two steaks that, you know, this one's got a big ribbon of collagen and it's not even the same muscle, you'll get different results. And I think this is one of the point. When I look at people who've done experiments and say, well, so-and-so did testing and they didn't find this result, look very carefully at were they cutting all the steaks from the same muscle and group, literally the same muscle, and were they neighboring steaks and were they grouping them together and making sure they were within a few grams of each other? Was the pan temperature controlled? Was the rate that they flipped the steak, which will determine how evenly it cooks, the same? Like the thing I tried to do after Meathead nudged me was to really rigorously control as many variables as possible so that I could be pretty confident. And of course, I rested it on a scale with a paper towel under it. And you have people, oh, well, you know, the paper towel absorbed the juices and prevented them from being reabsorbed. It was about 2 grams of juices in the paper towel during resting before I sliced it. Like, if you tell me you can chow into a, you know, 10-ounce steak and you can pick up, you know, 9 droplets of missing juices, literally 9 tiny droplets of missing juices, then you probably can pick up a, if somebody slips a pea under your mattress, you probably feel that too and don't sleep very well. It's like, you like, I think there's a lot of people taste what they want into the food. And that's real, right? You know, if you've gone on vacation and had a great bottle of wine while you're on holiday, or maybe you had a fantastic cigar, you know, when you were out on a nice golf course, like, yeah, it was better because of the whole experience. And if you cook the meat and what you believe and your rituals make you feel like you cooked a better steak, then you cooked a better steak. But objectively, it wasn't any juicier.
So I feel like this video, if you showed it to 10 out of, or if you showed it to 10 chefs who would preach resting and they actually watched this video all the way through, that still 10 out of 10 chefs would dismiss your findings and say that they feel...
And 9 out of 10. I know a few who would be like, oh, that's interesting. All right. 9 out of 10.
So, but they would still say resting is better. And I'm wondering if that isn't speaking to a bigger general problem where... You show somebody, I was just having this conversation a week or two ago with Jess Pryles about people that will take chicken out of packaging, put it in their sink, and then proceed to disinfect it with a combination of salt and citrus juice. So it doesn't happen, and you can tell them that, and you can show them that, and then the next time they get a pack of chicken, they're going to do the same thing. So as Jess said, they're being insolent. I feel like there would continue to be insolence in this case as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is something that sometimes, you know, there's mornings I wake up, check my YouTube comments, and I choose violence and go, you know, go get into arguments in the comments section. I try to be pretty good about that. Of like, hey, you know, you do you. I presented the data. If you don't want to believe it, that's on you. And look, this is always the case. Most people don't want to change their mind when presented with new data about anything, right? It's a slow process for us to change our beliefs. And one video isn't going to do it. Maybe if Kenji comes out and says, yeah, I was wrong too, and I think Chris is right, like maybe you'll start to get a few more people on the margin change. Like, the nature of science is it's very rare for one person to come along with saying new evidence and everybody goes, oh, well, we've been waiting for this the whole time. It tends to be you've got to hear it from multiple sources, multiple people. And then maybe at some point you try it and go, maybe it really didn't matter. And cooking's the same way. I remember in the early 2000s, I was a chef at a very avant-garde restaurant in England called The Fat Duck. And we were doing very experimental cuisine. And 9 out of 10 chefs would have thought we were crazy. They thought sous vide was crazy. It had no soul and all of these things. But here you are 20 years later, nobody even talks about sous vide, and yet everybody's doing it. Because, you know, eventually it became a tsunami you could not ignore. And one of the things that's interesting about chefs is a lot of the things we tend to believe as professional chefs are not actually grounded in good science. They tend to be things that we learned by being professional chefs, by working the job. And there's a lot of things we do that make complete sense in a fast-paced, busy restaurant kitchen. Like, why do we rest meat in the kitchen? Well, partially to basically time everything. Like, you finish the meat, you get off. This allows, when the meat comes out and starts to rest, the other chef knows to start the sauce. The other chef starts the vegetables. Because a big part of professional cooking is being able to pull 3-4 different things together and put it on the plate at the same time. Resting gives you sort of a window of not having to time everything with split second accuracy. And chefs have over time figured like, oh, it's better. Well, is it better because it made your life easier and it was easier to be more consistent because you weren't scrambling at the last second? Or is it objectively better because you did a bunch of tests and proved it to yourself? And I remember when I was working with Heston and Harold McGee would come around and we would do experiments and you'd have all these deeply held convictions. And then when you do it blind and you challenge those, more often than not, a lot of the stuff we believed as cooks was bullshit. But we still do it because it's actually practical and it makes it easier to deliver consistent food. So, you know, I know it's a bombastic video where I put this idea out there of resting is a myth admittedly, that's a bit of clickbait because it's YouTube and I'd like you to watch the video.
For sure.
But I hope I gave you enough evidence to challenge your beliefs a little bit. And maybe this summer, when you think you've basically completely ruined that steak because you pulled it off too late, just quickly slice into it. Stop that carryover cooking and save it. And if that makes, if that saves the day, maybe you'll start to realize that resting isn't the big deal that everybody has made it out to be. And what really matters is getting the job done as well as you can under the conditions you have.
What's the next big video that you're going to try and work on?
You know, there's two I'm working on right now. One, I'm working on one for barbecues and smokers. I've been, I have a thermometer that measures the surface temperature, which is the real temperature your food feels. And customers write in all the time saying, oh, the temperature gauge on my pit says it's 250, but your ambient sensor says it's only 140. It's like, yeah, both are right. Your pit is measuring the temperature really far away from the food. Mm. The steam evaporating from the food is cooling, like a cool cloud of moisture all around the food, lowering the temperature and helping to cause the stall. So I have one idea of basically like what's the real temperature in your smoker and how does this explain why following what Aaron Franklin does or choose any other great pit master, but trying to cook like them where they're cooking 20 briskets, 30 briskets at a time, that their conditions inside their smoker, their humidity are completely different than when you're doing one brisket. Mm. And you should change their recipe and you should modify your technique if you want your meat to experience the same thing their meat experienced. So that's one video, making that visually easy to understand, distilling it down into some useful takeaways. That's a job. So maybe later. So, and the other one I want to tackle is food safety. There's been some interesting things about what people believe about grilling chicken and how much you have to cook it. And I'm just tired of having overcooked chicken because people believe it's safer. So we're going to talk about that a little bit too.
All right. Well, we're looking forward to that. It's Chris Young from Combustion Inc. And don't forget, you can subscribe over at his YouTube channel at Chris Young Cooks when you go to YouTube. Chris, always appreciate the insight and the information. Look forward to the next one.
Greg, thank you. Have a great night.
You got it. Chris Young right there. Wow. Talk about mind-blowing, eye-opening, and all the other things in between. So if you have been a firm believer that resting has to happen, and especially for such and such period of time, I'm asking you, does that sway you in one direction or the other? Are you like, screw it, I'm still going to rest it? Or are you going to attempt to not unknowingly ruin your steak? Because who thought that resting could actually ruin the steak? You've nailed it. You've taken it off at the right temperature, and now it's resting and it's floating and floating and floating away. Oh, the horror. All right, let's wrap it up all the way back in the first hour. We had John or J2 McLemore, McLemore Boys. They got a new book coming out, Gather and Grill. You can pre-order right now on the Amazon.com. It will hit your front porch on April 7th. And of course, I mean May 7th. And then we had Mike McLeod, the original creator of the World Food Championships. We talked about the Famous Dave's All-Star Barbecue Series that is getting ready to start here in a couple weeks. Run all the way through the end of August. We also talked about the final table for last year's finalists at World Food Championships, and then we also talked about the move out of Dallas into Indianapolis for this November's World Food Championships and what that might look like, at least on the barbecue side of things. Second hour, Barry Enderwick. We talked about sandwiches. We talked about mayo. We talked about plussing up. We have credited with Barry Enderwick creating and/or minting, coining the phrase "plus up." So, if anybody else says it, you a Barry Enderwick fan? And then closing it out, Chris Young from Combustion Inc. New updates coming to the combustion thermometer. There's a sale going on. I think it was 20% off a package, which are the best rates of the year. And then we talked about the myth of resting steak. All right, so I forgot this was a bonus week. So new month, next Tuesday, we have Malcolm Reed. And then we may or may not have Andrew Zimmern. Sam the Cooking Guy backing him up and who knows what else. So how do I always leave you? September 11th, 2001. I will never forget. Until next Tuesday at 9 p.m. Eastern, this is your program host and proud U.S. American, Greg Rempe. Good night now.
Hi, this is Jeff Stone of Grandpa's Pride Barbecue from the Panhandle of Florida, and you are listening to the Barbecue Central Show.